November 2014 brought more than just stolen passwords and embarrassing celebrity emails. It ripped open the curtain on an industry in freefall. Sony Pictures, once a powerhouse where talent came first and profits followed, lay exposed, a studio clinging to an outdated playbook while the entire game had changed. What the leaked documents revealed wasn't corporate incompetence, but something far more unsettling: the wholesale transformation of an art form into a franchise assembly line. Amy Pascal, Sony's film chief, had built her career on star power and original stories. Now, she faced Wall Street investors demanding to know why her studio wasn't churning out superhero sequels. The hack didn't just humiliate Sony. It illuminated how Hollywood had fundamentally reimagined what movies exist to do. There was a time when diversity defined a studio slate. Sony thrived in the early 2000s by releasing 25 films annually, a mix of Adam Sandler comedies, prestige dramas, and occasional blockbusters like The Da Vinci Code. This strategy worked because of an unlikely savior, the DVD. Between 2002 and 2008, home video created what insiders called a welfare state for studios, generating roughly $15 profit per disc. Consumers eagerly built collections, with 15% of DVDs never even unwrapped. Even mediocre films became profitable through DVD sales, allowing studios to take creative risks on mid-budget dramas and romantic comedies. Amy Pascal and business partner Michael Linton formed an effective partnership. She handled creative instincts while he managed corporate strategy. Their complementary styles made Sony the nicest place to make a movie in town. But this golden era rested on a foundation about to crumble. When DVD sales collapsed from $22 billion in 2004 to $12 billion by 2016, the entire economic model evaporated overnight. Three seismic shifts converged around 2009 to fundamentally reshape movie making. First, DVD sales cratered as Netflix streaming, Redbox rentals, and piracy destroyed the ancillary revenue that had subsidized creative risk-taking. Second, international markets exploded, particularly China, which grew from under $1 billion in 2007 to over $6.6 billion by 2016. This pushed studios toward visual spectacle with minimal dialogue, easily translatable across cultures. Fast and Furious and Transformers became templates, while dialogue-heavy character studies became endangered. Third, television underwent a creative renaissance. Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, and The Wire offered production values and narrative complexity rivaling cinema. Even Amy Pascal admitted preferring Sunday nights watching Homeland to trips to the multiplex. These forces transformed moviegoing from habitual activity to occasional event. Between 2012 and 2016, 43 of the top 50 global hits were sequels, spin-offs, or adaptations. Original mid-budget films became financial suicide. The message? Familiarity and pre-awareness were the only paths to profitability. The superhero revolution began with a near-bankrupt comic book company and a second-tier character in a metal suit. When Iron Man grossed $585 million in 2008, it validated an audacious gamble. Marvel could make its own films using B-list heroes nobody had heard of. Under Disney's ownership, Marvel Studios maintained ruthless financial discipline, signing stars to multi-picture deals at modest salaries. Chris Hemsworth earned just $150,000 for Thor. Chris Evans got $1 million for Captain America. Only Robert Downey Jr. commanded premium pay after renegotiating. The studio's frugal approach proved conventional wisdom wrong by succeeding with previously unknown superheroes while creating an interconnected cinematic universe that dominated box office. Marvel's success wasn't just about superhero fatigue-proof storytelling. It was about building a self-perpetuating franchise machine that generated sequels, merchandise, and theme park attractions. When the Avengers grossed $1.5 billion worldwide, it demonstrated that branded intellectual property had replaced star power as Hollywood's most valuable asset. Studios scrambled to replicate Marvel's formula, desperately searching their libraries for anything with pre-existing brand recognition. Will Smith in Adam Sandler once commanded $20 million salaries, plus 20% of gross receipts, private jets, and lavish perks. Sony executives justified this with a simple phrase, "Will and Adam bought our houses." But by 2014, reality hit hard. Smith's After Earth lost over $25 million, while Sandler's That's My Boy bombed. Their production overhead was slashed in half, corporate jets vanished, and Sony courted younger stars like Chris Pratt. The trend was undeniable. Star-driven vehicles declined from half the top 20 grossing films in the early 2000s to just three by the 2010s. Audiences no longer appeared simply for a famous face. Both stars found refuge at Netflix, which offered creative freedom without box office pressure. Netflix paid Sandler nearly $20 million per film regardless of performance, spending $90 million on Smith Sprite. By 2017, Netflix users had watched over 500 million hours of Sandler's films. Movie stars hadn't disappeared. They had migrated to platforms where traditional metrics no longer mattered. Amy Pascal believed the Steve Jobs biopic could be the next Citizen Kane. Despite A-list talent including Aaron Sorkin, Danny Boyle, and Leonardo DiCaprio, Sony couldn't make the financials work. When Pascal proposed a $70 million budget, business partner Michael Linton refused. No, not at that number. Still a drama. The economics were brutal. Mid-budget dramas yielded modest profits at best, while franchise films delivered enormous returns. Even mediocre franchises attracted audiences through spectacle and brand recognition, whereas dramas competing with excellent television needed to be exceptional. By 2016, nearly every mid-budget drama flopped. Only four grossed over $100 million compared to nine in 2000. As one executive observed, "There just is no floor anymore." The riskiest category had become exactly what audiences claimed to want but rarely supported in theaters. Annapurna Pictures, founded by Megan Ellison, became the unlikely savior, backing prestigious projects traditional studios deemed too risky. When Steve Jobs moved to Universal, it bombed despite good reviews and Oscar nominations, confirming the industry's worst fears about mid-budget storytelling. By 2017, studios made films for non-traditional reasons. Amazon and Netflix produced content to sell subscriptions. Disney launched franchises that sold merchandise and drove theme park attendance. Universal ensured compelling content for Comcast's cable systems. When AT&T bought Time Warner for $85 billion, it signaled films would now keep people consuming data on mobile devices. For purists, this threatened cinema's cultural significance. Yet most people had watched films at home since VCRs became common 30 years earlier. Theater attendance continues declining despite luxury upgrades, while the distinction between films and television blurs. Breaking Bad represents a 45-hour movie better than most studio productions, while Marvel's interconnected superhero films function essentially as television episodes. Traditional filmmaking economics will increasingly narrow studio output to financially safe blockbusters, while subscription-funded films might offer hope for diverse storytelling if they keep subscribers loyal. Whether this shift expands creative possibilities or homogenizes content remains uncertain. We've entered an age where films are simply another form of content, a means to an end rather than cultural artifacts worth preserving. The question isn't whether Hollywood has changed, but whether what emerges deserves to be called cinema at all.